Our speaker for today is Mac DeFord. Mac was a Foreign Service officer from the mid-60s to the late 70s, serving initially in Vietnam and subsequently in the Arab world, including Beirut, Jeddah, and Amman. He joined Merrill Lynch International in 1978 and was assigned in Asia. He ran Merrill Lynch's Asian Private Banking Unit from Hong Kong until 1997. We're very happy to have Mr. DeFord with us today, and he is going to be speaking on key foreign policy issues for our new president. Please welcome Mac DeFord.
Hey, Lee, thank you very much. It's for the nice introduction. What Lee forgot to mention is that this happens to be our 25th, I was going to say wedding anniversary, the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Midcoast Forum. So it's an important occasion for us. The topic I picked, I'm going to give a plug to the Camden Conference, because the topic I picked, key foreign policy issues facing Obama, relates a lot to what the Camden Conference is going to be talking about, which I think is the weekend of February 19th. And the title of the conference this year is Global Leadership and the U.S. Role in Foreign Affairs. I've been involved with the Camden Conference for a long time, and was on the program committee this year. And as we started thinking about what would we be talking about and who the speakers would be, that's what gave me the idea for talking about what I'm talking about today. And I'll say this about the Camden Conference. This is our 25th anniversary. The Camden Conference is an offshoot of the Midcoast Forum, and I think it's in its 22nd or 23rd year. But a lot of the people that were involved in the founding of the Midcoast Forum were the founders of the Camden Conference. In any case, thinking about the U.S. role in the future, thinking about the problems that Obama is facing, there are two dramatic changes that he will be dealing with. One is on the economic side. Alan Greenspan, who's really, I would say, for the last generation has been the economic guru of the United States. He was, I think in 1987, he became the head of the Federal Reserve, and he stayed in that role until the year 2006. His underlying philosophy was that capitalism is self-regulating. He now has confessed, and I think that's the right word, that that is not the case. And there was a very interesting testimony that he gave before Congress about 6 weeks ago. And I think I'm going to quote one of the things that he said. And this is from him. Those who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself included, meaning Alan Greenspan, are in a state of shocked disbelief. He amplified this, and of course, as many of you remember, Alan Greenspan was well known for speaking in obscure phrases that purposely were designed so that nobody could understand exactly what he was saying. But at this point, he was quite clear. He amplified this by noting that, quote, this modern risk management paradigm held sway for decades. It collapsed last summer. He followed up, referring to his free market ideology, I have found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I have been very disturbed by that fact. Congressman Waxman, a Democrat who has long been speaking out against the fact that we don't have enough regulation in the financial industry, pressed former Fed chief Greenspan, to be even more precise. In other words, Mrs. Waxman, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right. It was not working. Is that correct? And Greenspan replied, absolutely, precisely. So in other words, what we found is that the last generation, the last 20 years, we've been operating, I would say, on a foundation, an economic foundation, that in fact turned out to be false. Of course, it all started with the collapse of the housing industry. the housing, the inflated prices of housing had led to excess credit. You remember, you know, if you have college students or kids, grandchildren's college students were getting credit cards given away in their mail. The net result of the collapse of the whole economic system is now that banks are undercapitalized, credit is frozen. When credit is frozen, small businesses go under. Consumers in the United States, I think 70% of our economy had been tied into consumer spending. Consumer debt is now a major problem. Consumers are defaulting. We've got a vicious circle going on here, and we haven't reached the bottom of it. The problem is that even if you have a buyer for a house that you're trying to sell, the buyer often can't sell his house in order to raise the money to buy your house, or he's unable to get the financing to buy your house. The bottom, as I said, is not yet in sight. So to summarize, on the economic front, we have a situation where, in effect, you can throw out the fundamental basis for our economy for the last 20 years. Now, of course, at some point, we'll get out of this. We got out of the Great Depression, we'll get out of it. And my guess would be that we'll end up over-regulating as we move ahead, which will probably stifle the economy in the future. We always have these pendulum swings, but we'll eventually get out of it. The problem now, you know, there's no point in worrying about the overregulation that's going to come in the future. The problem now is to get out of this collapsing economic situation that we face. The federal government is already, as you know, they've already poured hundreds of billions of dollars into it. It'll be trillions of dollars before the whole thing is over. Ultimately, I think we're going to face, you know, we're in essence printing money. We're going to, you know, right now we're in a deflationary period. Ultimately, we'll end up with a weaker dollar. We'll end up with higher inflation. So the price of this sort of dream world that we've been living in, where the economy and capitalism regulates itself, the price is going to be pretty stiff. Moving into foreign policy, I would also say that for the last, not for the last generation, but for the last 8 years, we know what that means, the term of George Bush's presidency, our policy too has been based on false premises. The false premise was that we live in a unipolar world in which the United States can do whatever it wants and that everybody else has to fall in line. Bush, too, in an interview, I was away, but in an interview, it was quite interesting that he gave to Charlie Gibson. I was staying in some small town, literally in the middle of nowhere in Turkey, and the guy, the innkeeper, we were the only people staying there, who spoke remarkably good English that he'd learned from tourists. He came in the morning we were having breakfast, and he said, Bush just admitted, I just heard it on the radio, Bush just admitted that the entire Iraq war was a mistake. Well, he didn't quite say that, but it was something of a sort of, I'd say, a quasi mea culpa. And the quote was from him, I wish the intelligence had been different on the weapons of mass destruction for Iraq. If you think about it, it's almost a line from Saturday Night Live, because the fact of the matter is that the intelligence was different. But his neocon advisors, and he bought into it, were manipulating the intelligence in such a way to justify the invasion of Iraq. Now, the underlying theory for going into Iraq was basically the sense that we could jumpstart the confusion in the Middle East. We could jumpstart democracy in the Middle East by going in and invading Iraq. In other words, we could, it was almost like the Gordian knot. It was almost Alexander's idea. If we can't solve it, we'll just cut the damn thing in half and everything will work. Now, there were several fallacies with that, fallacies or more than fallacies, total misunderstanding of the situation. First of all, I would say that Bush and his advisors probably didn't realize that Saddam Hussein, whatever his faults, and God knows there were many, it was a Sunni regime. The Iranians, who were classified by Bush as one of the three members of the Axis of Evil, were a Shiite regime. Once you got rid of Saddam, when Iraq has a majority Shiite population, you were in effect going to throw Iraq into Iran's orbit. And that's basically what has happened. I saw, just as we were driving in today, I saw a headline in the New York Times. The lead article said something about 25 or 45 Iraqis had been arrested in an attempted coup, presumably, and it said something about trying to set up Saddam's Ba'athist regime again or something to that effect. Obviously, the people that were arrested were Sunni. Whether they had in mind trying to overthrow the government or whether the current Shiite government is trying to get rid of all Sunnis that have any leadership role in the country, which is what I believe. But what you've got, because Bush and his team did not understand the dynamics of Iraq, you've got a country that is closer to being under the influence of Iran than it has ever been. Fallacy number two was that a democratic Iraq, or I'll rephrase that, because of the United States invasion of Iraq, the fear that we generated because of that would all of a sudden make the Palestinian issue disappear. In other words, you would have something where the Arabs would look, oh my God, look what the United States is going to do. They're going to run around. They're going to invade us if we don't behave. And that was part of the reason, I think, this belief that the barrel of a gun could solve problems. That was the reason that up until a year ago, the first 7 years of Bush's regime, he ignored the Palestinian situation, the Israeli-Palestinian situation. And when he finally started to do something about it, the meeting, the conference with, I think, 50 different countries in Annapolis this time last year, I mean, let's face it, it was a photo op. Everybody at the time knew it was going to go nowhere, and it went nowhere. The third fallacy that was underlying the Bush administration and his advisors' belief about the world was that democracy would bring moderates to power. Well, if you look what happened in with the Palestinians as a start, you ended up with Hamas getting more votes. And Hamas, of course, now controls Gaza, and you've got a split. You've got enough of a problem between the Palestinians and the Israelis without having the Palestinians split between two forces. In Lebanon, through free elections, Hezbollah is probably now the most influential of all the parties. You've got an enormous number of parties in Lebanon. The fear is there are going to be parliamentary elections in, I think, later the spring of 2009. And it's quite likely that you'll end up with Hezbollah actually controlling parliament. As you know, neither Hamas nor Hezbollah do we recognize. So you've got a massive fix-it job facing Obama. You've got financial stabilization. If I'd given this talk 6 months ago, there would not have been, from my point of view, there would not have been the need to emphasize the financial problems around the world. But when you look at the situation today, the first thing that the new president has to focus on is going to be financial stabilization. I mean, that's more important than all the political foreign policy problems around the world. It needs, if you go back to the high-tech bust of 7 or 8 years ago, if you go back to the early 1990s when Japan collapsed, when Japan's economy collapsed, these were things that could be contained. But in a globalized world where the United States is far and away the strongest economic power. When our economy collapses, then it becomes a worldwide crisis. So we've got to be spending, and Bush has been doing this. Obama's going to have to do it even more so. We've got to work closely with the European Union. We've got to work closely with China. We've got to coordinate policies. And that's very complicated. It's a lot easier if one country has a problem for one country to resolve that problem. But when you've got a worldwide problem, and you've therefore got to coordinate around the world, it's going to make it much more difficult. I mean, we already see where the Europeans are split, the Germans are not throwing money at it the way the rest of the Europeans are. The problem that I foresee, I'd sort of call it the lurking danger, is that you've got the developing world, the third world, they're going to be tremendously affected by this. They already are. You've got an unstable world in any case, but you're going to find as the third world gets into the kind of economic problems that we're getting into, it's bad enough for us, but we can deal with it. It's going to be very difficult for the developing world to deal with it. So you're going to have more upheaval. You're going to have more civil unrest. I wonder what's going to happen in China. You're going to have more revolutions. So you've got a financial economic collapse that is going to reverberate around the world in terms of political problems as well. From a political point of view, obviously I've been focusing on the Middle East, but I think anybody who looks at the world today, the major concern is the Middle East. It's the most unstable, it's the most dangerous place that we have to deal with. If we start with Iraq, the good news about Iraq is that they want us out and we want to get out. There are a lot of people in this room, and there are a lot of people listening to NPR who were probably against going into Iraq in the first place. Fine, but we're there. We've got to get out, but we've got to get out in the most effective, well, I'll put it this way, the most effective way, that's almost impossible. We've got to get out in a way that does the least damage to the situation in the rest of the Middle East. Now, this necessarily, I believe, involves dealing with Iran. Whatever we think of Iran, whatever we think of the current regime, we've got to be talking to Iran. Now, my own view is that you've got a situation where the Iraqi Shiite government is going to, regardless of what we do or how we try to prevent it, they're going to be coming more and more under the influence of Iran. We should not try to prevent this. We should try to accept this. As a matter of fact, we should use this as something of a trade-off in dealing with Iran to get Iran to stop its push for nuclear weapons. Because if the trade-off is, okay, we understand Iraq is in your sphere of influence, we won't push too hard on this, but you've got to stop nuclear weapons, that may work. It's going to be tricky, but it may work. King Abdullah of Jordan six years ago was talking about his concern. This was before the Iraq invasion, but when it was obviously it was coming, he was talking about the fact that you were going to have what he referred to as a Shiite arc stretching from South Lebanon, which is predominantly Shiite, through parts of Syria into Iraq and into Iran. And in fact, that's what you've got. It's, of course, the what I would call the Shiite ascendancy has been heightened by Hezbollah's, Hezbollah is primarily funded by Iran. And in 2006, summer 2006, when Israel went into South Lebanon, it was primarily to destroy Hezbollah. Hezbollah survived. They didn't win, but it was like the guy who threw shoes at George Bush the other day in Baghdad. He didn't hit Bush, but he came out a hero. Hezbollah didn't win the war, but they came out a hero. Which is obviously, somewhat destabilizing. The most destabilizing aspect of the Middle East, obviously, is the Palestinian-Israeli thing. clearly, to resolve this, we've got to be talking to Hamas. We've got to get Hamas and the Fatah, the PLO, we've got to somehow get them to come together. We can't possibly do that if we ignore one side of it. My own view is that ever since Oslo, going back to the early 90s, we've been playing the role, quote, of the honest broker, trying to bring the Israelis and Palestinians together, as it were, under our honest brokerage auspices. The fact of the matter is, over the last 8 years, as everybody is aware, when George Bush wasn't ignoring the Palestinian-Israeli problem, he was siding, 99% with Israel. So the United States no longer is considered an honest broker in the context of Israel and Palestine. I don't necessarily think that matters one way or the other, but I think we've got to realize this. What the United States should be doing at this point, there's something called the quartet, which is the EU, Russia, the United States, and the UN. We should be talking to to the quartet in great detail. The irony of the whole thing is that for the last 10 years or 15 years, ever since Oslo started, the outlines of the final settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians are pretty widely known. There were a bunch of moderate Israelis and moderate Palestinians who met in Geneva about 3 or 4 years ago and came up with something called the Geneva Accords. Basically, you're going to have a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem. You're going to maintain a unified Jerusalem. How you work out the modalities of having two capitals in one city, one's in West Jerusalem, one's in East Jerusalem. But that's got to be part of a settlement, or the Palestinians won't buy into it. You're going to have to go back to the 67 borders. Now, they talk about rectifications of the borders because you've probably got about 500,000 Israelis have moved into the West Bank. But 250,000 of those are in the, broadly speaking, the suburbs of Jerusalem. So you incorporate the suburbs. You've got to, obviously, if you're going to have East Jerusalem as the capital, you've got to have a contiguous arrangement between East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank from the Palestinian point of view. But you incorporate those 250,000 Israelis that are now in the suburbs of Jerusalem, the West Bank, you incorporate that into Israel proper. Maybe, 15, 20 square miles. And then you give the Palestinians, you give them 15 or 20 square miles down in the Negev Desert. So that from a perspective of fairness, you're saying that they got the same amount of land that they lost in 67. Another issue is the acknowledgement of the right of return of refugees. The Palestinians talk about this all the time. The Israelis point out, and everybody else points out, if you return the refugees and their offspring to Israel, the ones that left, demographically, overnight, there would be no more Jewish Israel. It would become two-thirds Arab, two-thirds Muslim, whatever. It certainly wouldn't be Jewish Israel. But what you can do is state in principle, the Israelis say, in principle, we accept the right of return. Realistically, what we're going to do, and the Arabs, I think, would buy into this, realistically, because the Israelis accept the principle, realistically, what we're going to do, we're going to say the only Arabs that can return to Israel were those who actually left in 1948 and 1967, not their children, not their grandchildren. And if you look at, this program like this would take 5 years, if you started negotiating it tomorrow, it would take 5 years before you'd get any results. So somebody who left Israel a day old in 1948 would be 66 years old. That's not a demographic threat. That woman is not going to have a lot of children when she moves to Israel. The same thing as 67, 70, you'd be 47, 48 years old. Let those people go back. Most of them won't want to go back. There may be a few people who have brothers, sisters, whatever, want to return. But by and large, it'd be very few people who would want to go back. And those that went back would pose no demographic threat to Israel at all. Obviously, what you would have to do in terms of refugees, if you're going to take 250,000 Israelis and move them from the West Bank, the ones that aren't in the suburbs of Jerusalem, you know, you're going to have to give Israel a lot of money to relocate them back to Israel. At the same time, you've got a whole bunch of Palestinian refugees you're going to have to, who are not going to go back to Israel, but you want to resettle them. Some of them may want to be resettled in the West Bank. You're going to have to pour billions of dollars into that. But I don't know where the money's going to come from, since we're pouring billions of dollars into our own banks at this point. But over the long term, to spend $20, $30, $40 billion to resettle Israelis into Israel and to resettle Palestinians into the West Bank is a lot cheaper than permitting this thing to go on. You would have to, the final peace deal would involve a demilitarization of Palestine for the indefinite future. You would obviously want to have UN forces along the new border. And I think the Israelis would probably want to have American soldiers involved in this. Certainly, it makes sense to guarantee this. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia has already said that a settlement along these lines, that he's got the Arab countries to agree that they would open full diplomatic relations with Israel. You'd obviously want to have free trade, though free trade, as we know, even without any problems like the Arab-Israeli one. Free trade is, you know, it's got to be negotiated between states. But you would certainly encourage the Arabs to come out ahead on this one, because the Israeli economy is so strong that if there were open borders and free trade between Palestine and new state of Palestine and Israel, it would stabilize things a lot. Of course, as you're doing what I'm talking about, when I'm talking about the settlement, and I'm saying that there's no longer a role for the United States as an honest broker, the role for the United States is to get the world interested, the quartet, as I say, the EU, Russia, the UN, and the Arab countries. We'd clearly be talking to Israel the whole time. But at some point, we would have to get the UN to agree on this settlement. It would not be something that the Palestinians and the Israelis would be asked to conclude on their own, which is what we've been doing for the last 20 years unsuccessfully. Because if you're asking the Israelis and Palestinians to agree, you're asking the reverse of the old biblical David and Goliath. I mean, the Israelis are one of the five strongest countries militarily in the world. The Palestinians, have nothing, a bunch of rocks and a bunch of rockets they can launch in occasionally. So with that kind of disparity, disequilibrium, you're never going to get them to work it out on your own. So the world has to work it out. The world has to present it. A lot of moderate Israelis would like it. A lot of more right-wing Israelis would not. A lot of moderate Palestinians would like it. A lot of more radical Palestinians would not. But with the Arab world pushing on the Palestinians, and with the United States and the rest of the world pushing on the Israelis, I think it would eventually work. In any case, to me, it's the most, and I think to a lot of people, it's the most destabilizing factor in the Middle East. Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not going to be resolved because the Arab-Israeli problem is resolved. I don't believe that Afghanistan is going to be resolved because President Obama puts 20,000 more troops in there, or 40,000 more troops, or 140,000 more troops. Troops are not the answer. Now, I haven't got time to get into this. I want to save time for questions. Obviously, if you wanted to put troops in because the situation on the ground is so dangerous now that even Kabul is at risk, and therefore you've got to slow the decline, okay. But you've got to stop talking about the possibility of a military victory in Afghanistan, because there's no such thing. Again, it's who we talk to. We've got to start talking to the Taliban. It's interesting because, again, if you go back to Iran, there are two things where our interests and Iran's interests coincide when it comes to Afghanistan. First of all, the western border of Iran is Afghanistan. There's no country in the world that wants a unstable, failed state on its border. Iran has every interest in seeing a relatively stable Afghanistan. The second thing is the Taliban are Sunni, as you know, the Iranians are Shiite. They do not want a Taliban victory in Afghanistan. So the Iranians and we, the Americans, have two interests that coincide. We both want a stable Afghanistan, and neither one of us want to see the Taliban take over. That's very useful. What I would see long term, it's going to be slow, it's going to be difficult, is the possibility of sort of a coalition government with the warlords, with the some moderate Taliban, with some members of the Karzai government. It's workable. It would be a very decentralized state, but Afghanistan has always been decentralized, so that's not a problem. But as I say, from my point of view, the concept of thinking you can throw more troops into it, it's not going to work. The other thing to remember about Afghanistan is over the last, well, I'll put it this way, one of the reasons the military resolution is not possible under any circumstances, but so long as you've got, and you always will have, this porous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the Taliban or other militant anti-government forces can move into Pakistan whenever they want, that makes it virtually impossible. Our solution over the past 6 months has increasingly been to bomb some of the Taliban camps in Pakistan. It's very risky. I think it is true. You see reports that the Pakistan government complains about it, but it's done with a wink and a nod because we've let them know that we're going to do this. That's fine. But Pakistan itself is a very unstable country these days. And the fact that the government is going to permit the United States to attack in Pakistan against the Taliban does not please most of the people who live in that part of Western Pakistan, the Pashtun troops. And you can, if you think a destabilized or failed state in Afghanistan is a risk, let me tell you, a failed state in Pakistan is a much, much bigger risk. And the more pressure we put on Pakistan and the more active we become in terms of going into Pakistan itself, and we always seem to, when we're attacking, we hit more wedding parties than we ever hit enemy soldiers, but that's another issue. So it's a very dangerous thing we're doing, and that's why I say we've got to start coming up with a solution that may not be the solution that we would like. It may not be a Karzai democratically elected government in Pakistan forever. One final thing I'd say about Afghanistan. If I were the American government, again, who knows where the money is going to come from, but this would be relatively cheap. Buy up all the opium. If I were in charge, I would legalize drugs, but that's another issue. But let's not go there. But what we can do very cheaply is buy up the opium. In Turkey, Turkey produces legally a lot of opium. You know, they sell it to drug companies for morphine-based things. So I don't know how much opium is needed by drug companies, but if we buy it up and pay the same thing that is now being paid to the farmer, and the money is going into the coffers of the Taliban, if we buy it up from the farmer and cut out the Taliban, that's a much more effective way than what we're trying to do now. Finally, one final thing, I want to mention Russia. I think, and this is, George Bush didn't start this, this started under Clinton. I think we've made some major mistakes with Russia. And I think it all came to a head with this silly war in Georgia, which even at the time it appeared that the Russians hadn't instigated, and more the information is coming out. Sure, the Russians were sitting there waiting for the Georgians to be so stupid as to start it, but the Georgians did start it and the Russians took advantage of it. But the reason the Russians are so upset, I mean, if you think about it, suppose during the Cold War period, the Soviet Union had developed treaties with Mexico and all of Central America. And what we have been doing, as I said, it began with Clinton, what we have been doing is we have been encircling Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which made no sense. I mean, NATO was invented during the Cold War to fight the Soviet Union. Once the Soviet Union collapsed, there wasn't a great need for NATO. And we seem to have reinvented the need for NATO to force the Russians into a corner. Now, we've got a lot of things that we need Russia on. Nuclear disarmament is very important. We should be talking to the Russians as equals. We shouldn't be encircling Russia and making them think that we believe they're the old Soviet Union. There's no need to put, I believe, there's no need to put a missile defense system in Poland. And every time the Americans get together with the Russians ask us why we're doing this, and we give them some explanation about Iranian missiles. I mean, would you believe that? So we have backed, we have encouraged Russia to think like the old Soviet Union. And at a time, and as I say, I'm not going to blame this on Bush, it goes back to Clinton as well. At a time when there are so many things going on in the world where you need Russian support, beginning with, Iran, nuclear disarmament, the whole situation in the Caucasus, there's an awful lot of need for what I would call treating the Russians as equals, as partners in trying to make the world a less dangerous place. Finally, a couple of non-geopolitical issues, energy, oil prices, as everybody knows, has collapsed. I was away for a couple of months. I came back to Portland a few days ago, walked around the corner from our apartment to a gas station, and it said $1.66. I mean, when I left, it was $3.25. I mean, I thought I was, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was one of those gas stations that had gone bust a couple of years ago and had never taken down their price signs. If I wanted to do something, if I were Obama and wanted to do something really unpopular but necessary, what you've got to do over a period of time is fix, it's what the Europeans do, is fix the price so that, let's say that you think that $125 a barrel is what the price of oil could be. When it falls down to, as it is now, $40 a barrel, you don't let gas go for $1.66. You continue to charge $3.25 as tax, and the federal government picks up the difference, and we can use it. God knows we've got a lot of things to use it on. But what you really end up using it for, you wouldn't have the situation with the big three automobile makers that you have now if the price of gasoline had been what the Europeans have been charging for the last 20 years. And you obviously have more money coming in for R&D. When we were in Turkey, we rented two different cars. One was getting about 42, 43 miles a gallon. The other was getting about 52, 53 miles a gallon. Neither one were hybrid. But if you pay $7-$8 a gallon for gas, you demand cars that do pretty well in that. So that's energy. Water resources are going to be a major issue as well. Environmental global warming. If Bush had not dissed Kyoto, the Senate would have voted against the Kyoto Treaty. The mistake was for the administration to come out and in effect say that we are against Kyoto, we don't believe in global warming. Even if they'd said we believe in global warming, but what in effect they said was we think the Kyoto Treaty is unfair because it's disadvantageous to developed countries. The Chinese and the Indians can look at it and say, listen, for 200 years since the Industrial Revolution began, you all, because of carbon emissions, you all have been creating the environmental problem. You all have been heating up the earth. The Chinese, the Indians, we need a little bit of a break here. And for us, the West, whether it's the United States or the United States and Europe, for us to think that they should sign on to exactly the same kind of restraints that we can afford is a little bit, frankly, unfair. So sure, we've got to encourage the Chinese. I mean, not every month is going to be the Olympics in Beijing, so you can't expect them to absolutely close down what they're doing. But you can work with them and not hold them to the same standards that frankly, the West has got to be held to. Nuclear disarmament, I've talked about. I think that's going to be increasingly important. free trade. I think everybody's in favor of globalization and free trade. But when you get into the economic downturn's a moderate word for what we're in. The first thing, and it happened, it probably was one of the causes of the Great Depression. What happens is countries close off their borders, and they turn inward, and they're always worried about jobs, and obviously we're worried about jobs. But if we close ourselves down, if we permit free trade to get lost in the shuffle, it's going to be much worse long term. So we've got to keep our eye on this. It worries me because Obama, at least when he was talking during the campaign, I thought he was talking more about keeping the kind of jobs onshore that frankly lead to a closing down of trade, which I think would be very unfortunate. In short, let me close with this thought. Teddy Roosevelt famously said, what you've got to do is speak softly and carry a big stick. We've got a very big stick. We've got the biggest stick, relatively speaking, that I think any country in the world has ever had. I mean, our military expenditure annually is twice what the rest of the developed world and China put together is. So militarily, we're stronger than we need to be. And the rest of the world knows that. What we don't need is to speak arrogantly and in everybody's face. A unipolar world, even with the strength of the United States, is not possible because there's so many multilateral issues out there. And it's really incumbent on us to deal with people like the Chinese, like the Russians, obviously like our friends the Europeans, as equals, because there are going to be plenty of times when we need them. And the fact that we're as strong militarily as we are, look at Vietnam, look at Iraq, look at Afghanistan. It doesn't solve the problems, and we shouldn't pretend that it does. So on that cheery note, how about some questions? Yeah, the question is about my comment about the right of return for Palestinians to go back, in theory, in principle, to what is now the State of Israel. And the question was saying, well, how about all the Jews that were thrown out after 48 by the Arab countries? How do you compensate them? It's a very fair question. I mean, I think, in terms of what you're going to do in settling the big picture, I think there ought to be compensation provided. Obviously, at least I say obviously, I would think it very unusual to expect anybody, Jew living in Israel who would come from Cairo would want to go back, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be some form of compensation. Yeah. The question is there a political will in the Obama administration to, in effect, force a settlement rather than playing the honest broker with the Palestinians and Israelis? To be perfectly honest, I don't know. I would have, again, you're in a situation where the financial problems are so great that that's going to be his first focus. I hope so is all I can say. I don't know. What do you think? Now, if you look at it, people, what they say during a campaign and what they actually end up doing can be different. And the only thing that I can say is at some point, I think Obama's a very smart man, and at some point it's going to occur to him, if it hasn't already, that if you can't resolve the Palestinian-Israeli situation, you're always going to have a destabilizing, unstable Middle East, and it's going to get worse and not better. And I mean, I agree with you. I remember reading Dennis Ross's book. Everybody always holds Dennis Ross up as the most wonderful, objective person. He wrote a fascinating book for 600 pages, and it certainly seemed to be true, and it was very objective, and at the end he turned around and blamed the whole thing on Arafat. But the book didn't show that. It just sort of, it hadn't worked. He plotted on for, God, the poor guy, Ross was working 24/7, as they say. Not that anybody ever works 24/7, but, he was working his butt off and the whole thing collapsed, and he had to find somebody to blame. But if you looked at the history that he himself presented, it didn't seem to blame Arafat. So I don't find him particularly objective. But I think if you're going to, at some point, Bruce, you're going to have to deal with it. Maybe the problem is people always put it off to their second term, and then it's too late, Tom. The question is if Assad in January, when the final investigation is completed, is about the assassination of Hariri, if he is shown to have been behind the assassination of Hariri, will Assad be able to survive? My guess is that it won't really have any impact on the internal situation in Syria, because after all, if Assad was behind it, I doubt that it was his idea. It was the whole establishment, the whole establishment of the Syrian regime. So my guess is that it wouldn't in and of itself be the cause for the downfall of him. Syria is it's interesting because Syria, as you know, Syria and Israel are talking through Turkey, and again, it's a hell of a lot simpler than the Palestinian situation, because the Israelis know exactly what the Syrians need. Because if you recall, about 10 years ago, when Clinton was around, they came very, very close. And Clinton actually, I think, went to Geneva and met with Assad Sr. because, you know, they were talking about a couple hundred yards along the Sea of Galilee. He thought he could persuade him. And the Syrian position is, we want every inch back, and that's it. Right now, I mean, it would seem to me, from a purely defensive military point of view with Israel, the Golan Heights are not that important. It would be more important for Israel to have a peace deal with Syria. Obviously, Syria is not going to overnight switch, but part of it, they would, slow down their support for Hezbollah. They would become much less radical. So I think it would be in Israel. And it wouldn't surprise me if that happens long before the Palestinian thing. But I don't think the Hariri investigation is going to overthrow Assad. The question is, what happens to the major oil producers if the price of oil stays as low as it is now? Saudi Arabia, Russia. Well, I suppose for Russia, you know, Putin will stop being so confident, you know, as he is now. Saudi Arabia, if you go back about 6 or 8 years, Saudi Arabia had a very, was in a weak economic situation about 6 or 8 years ago when the price was down at $25 a barrel. They have both, certainly Saudi Arabia, certainly Russia, they have both built up enormous reserves. I don't, you know, and I'm not an oil expert, God knows, but even oil experts have no idea what the future is going to bring. Nobody would have predicted this 140 to 40 bucks in 3 months. My guess is that that's not going to happen, that the price of oil is not going to stay as low as this, and that because the major oil producers have built up reserves, it's not going to impact them negatively. Where the two countries that I think it will impact, and from our point of view, positively, is Venezuela and Iran. Because I think Iran has wasted a lot of money, and Venezuela, you know, they're spreading all their money around and trying to be the anti-American good guys in South America. And they should be spending much more at home. So I think it's going to hurt, it would hurt Chavez, fine, and it would perhaps help make Iran be more moderate. So I think it would be good news. I think it would hurt the bad guys and not necessarily hurt the good guys as much. Judy. The question is, since I just spent a couple of months in Turkey, if I were advising Obama, what his policy towards Turkey should be. Turkey has, over the last couple of years, it's interesting, Turkey's become, it used to be a country that sort of hid away. It's obviously in a very dangerous part of the world. It didn't want to get involved. Its foreign policy was, in effect, to be pro-American and to have no foreign policy. It's now become much more active. It's become active in the Caucasus. It's become, it had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with Russia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, because Armenia and Azerbaijan have been at each other's throats. So it's trying to play a constructive role. Now, it's not trying to play a constructive role so it'll get a gold star. I mean, after all, that's its neighborhood, so it wants to tamp things down. There's that thing that comes up every year, which is the Armenian resolution that some people in Congress want to push through. And Bush has successfully knocked it down. I can't imagine that Obama wouldn't knock it down, because it makes absolutely no sense to come up with something that blames the current Turkish government on something that happened under the Ottoman Empire. But that would have a very negative effect. What is interesting in Turkey, and it sort of goes into the whole global Islamic religious revival, and that is, and you see in Istanbul what you, and I've been going to Turkey for 40 years, what you never used to see, which is women wearing scarves to show their identity. And my wife is from Istanbul, and it enrages her. She wants to rip the scarves off. I was talking to an American anthropologist who is on a Fulbright scholarship there, who's been going to Turkey since 1973. And her attitude was, she said, of course you see these people in Istanbul and in the big cities much more than you used to, because they have more money, so they're coming in from the provinces, and you see them in stores, and you see them in places you wouldn't. But actually, it's a very good deal, because what is really happening is, she said, they are becoming more moderate. They are not influencing the secular people nearly as much as they are being influenced by secular influences in the big cities. So that's the other side of it. The Kurdish situation with Turkey. I think the Turks have played it pretty badly, because, you know, again, you go back to Ataturk founding the Turkish nation. I guess it was 1923, 1924, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And it's ironic, because Ataturk was a blonde, blue-eyed man from Macedonia. I don't think he had a drop of Central Asian Turkic blood in him, but he created this Turkish nation. And part of what he did to create it was he turned everybody into a Turk. Kurds, who have been there for thousands of years, didn't want to be turned into Turks, but they put up with it for a long time. Now, over the last 20 years, you know, they want their own language, they want to be able to go to their own schools, and I frankly believe that Turkey is strong enough now internally that they could let this happen. And they're letting radio stations broadcast in Kurdish. So they're moving in that direction, but they're just very afraid. And, you know, there's so many nations like this. They're very afraid that if they let down their guard, and especially with what's going on in northern Iraq, that you'll end up with a push for a separate state. I mean, that's the problem. I think they're overplaying there. I think they're being unnecessarily rough, but who knows? So. The question is about what's the attitude of the typical Turk towards the European Union? Do they want to join the European Union? If you go back 5 years ago, the typical Turk, say it was two-thirds wanted to join, one-third was against it. Because of what's happened, because of the way the EU has treated them, this is their perspective, the Turkish perspective, by sort of stonewalling them, and, you know, Sarkozy and some other European leaders have said, you know, we don't want to turn, you know, they're not Europeans, they're Muslims, we don't want them in. So what has happened over the last couple of years is, and they've let in a lot of countries, or they've moved a lot of countries to the front, a lot of Eastern European countries that are, you know, Dimitri's here, Andrew's not here. I was going to say they've moved countries like Bulgaria that probably have a lower per capita income than Turkey. They've moved them to the front line. So the Turks are annoyed. So now you talk to the man in the street, the Turks say, I don't want to join the EU. You know, I mean, I don't want any club that doesn't want me to be a member. I don't want to be a member of it. So you've got a big backlash, a big backlash. And the guy who Erdogan, who's currently in power, who's the Islamist party, you know, moderate Islamist party, but Islamist party nevertheless, who was pushing for the EU a couple of years ago, he slowed this push down, and that's actually made him more popular as a result. Any more? So the question is, how is Hillary Clinton, as the Secretary of State, going to do with the Palestinian issue, and who in the UN, and I assume you mean not on the American side of the UN, but who in the UN would be able to push the Israeli-Palestinian thing? You know, if you go back, Hillary is a politician. Hillary at one point got into a lot of trouble because she kissed Yasser Arafat's wife. I don't know, do you all remember that? So, you know, I mean, I happen to believe she's a very pragmatic person. Now, you know, you can only go so far. It goes back to the question that Brewster was asking, how far does Obama want to push the thing? But I don't think Hillary would be the problem. No, I think Hillary would be fine. I think she's very competent, and I thought it was a wise choice. As for the UN, I really, you know, I don't know. I mean, the UN is not going to get out ahead of the United States, but if the United States, if the Obama administration encourages the UN, whether it's going to be, you know, I suppose they could appoint somebody, would probably be a good idea to be in charge of this, but I haven't a clue who. Time for one more, if there is one more. The question is what's my view of all the American bases around the world? I don't know whether they're 800, but I did read somewhere that we've got bases in 150 different countries, which, you know, could easily add up to 800. Frankly, I think it's probably, if you look at it from a cost-effective basis, I don't think it's cost-effective. I mean, I think we're probably spending an enormous amount of money to have these bases all around the world that aren't necessarily effective. So I would look at it, but it's like anything else. If you ever tried to close a base, a military base in the United States, you know, it's very difficult to do. And presumably, within the Pentagon, you've always got somebody who's saying, and you've got other countries that presumably like having the bases there. So it's probably more a political thing than a military thing. But I would certainly agree with you. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And if, you know, Gates isn't going to be around forever, but somebody in the Pentagon should start a serious analysis of this whole thing to find out how much it costs and how effective it really is. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, the question is, are we overextending? And I think it's, I think if you look at our financial situation, yeah, we are overextending. And I mean, I think, as I was saying earlier, I think what you're, if you end up where the Chinese have more, you know, $600 billion worth of U.S. treasuries that we're gonna have to, they're gonna have to be lending us, this is really weird, to recapitalize our banks. They've got all the money, we don't have the money. So, you know, the dollar, I think, is gonna be devaluing over a period of time once we get out of the mess that we're in now. So I think we do have a serious problem down the road, but it's not just military, it's economic as well. Thank you very much.